Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donatio, and today my guest is Dr. Waqar Khan. He's a medical physician who is board certified in interventional cardiology in the greater Houston area. He is also a fellow of the American College of Cardiology. Dr. Khan is an affiliate faculty member in the Department of Cardiology at Baylor College of Medicine. And he's also the number one best-selling author of the book, Be Heart Smart. Dr. Khan received his medical degree from King Edward Medical University in Pakistan and a master's degree in public health from the University of Texas Health Sciences Center in Houston. Dr. Khan completed his cardiology training at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston and St. Elizabeth Medical Center right here in Boston at Tufts University School of Medicine. He has been in practice for over 20 years and has dedicated his career to treating and advising patients to improve their heart health. His passion is in preventative health and in treating cardiovascular disease. Dr. Khan, I am so happy to have you with us, and thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to come on the show and share a lot of your incredible wisdom with us.
Thank you, Dr. Donatio. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome. We had a terrific discussion, a pre-interview discussion, where you were talking about one of the things you're very passionate about is helping individuals to become aware of the dangers of coronary heart disease. Because I think you said 750,000 people in the United States die every year of this deadly condition.
Correct.
And you want to help people to identify and prevent how they, you know, and to prevent it and how they can take care of themselves. So please jump in and start talking about
Sure.
your wonderful interventional cardiology practice and what it is that we all need to know.
Dr. Donatio, you're so correct. I mean, there's one out of three deaths, nonviolent deaths in the United States, is from cardiovascular disease. So heart is the number one killer. And I think it's so important for your audience to know that we must do whatever we can to protect patients, protect folks from getting heart disease. So it's very important. My daily interaction with patients is about prevention of disease, about diagnosis of disease, and treatment of those patients who have developed blockages. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm happy to talk about different aspects of cardiovascular disease, whether it be prevention or treatment or diagnosis.
Right. Well, we talked about, and this is most people really want to know, okay, what can I do? Unfortunately, they mistakenly think that that genetics has everything to do with it. Oh, well, my mother died and my grandmother died of heart disease. That means I'm going to get it. So one of the things I'd love for you to talk about is helping people understand that genetics is not cast in stone, that genetics is a very fluid thing that we have a lot of control over with our lifestyle, and then how they can change their view of that and take control of their habits and their behavior and their lifestyle so that they don't get cardiovascular.
Absolutely. I mean, you're so right about that. So, you know, genetics is only one of the risk factors for developing heart disease. There are so many other risk factors. Some of the major risk factors that we should never forget are history of smoking, patients who are smokers, those people who have a history of diabetes or high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol are also risk factors. So you know, before we even go to medications, so many different changes in our lifestyle that will lower these risk factors that I named earlier will reduce the incidence of heart disease.
Yes, of course. I mean, absolutely. How do you approach, I know this, you're very passionate about this, how do you approach with your patients getting them to get on the track of understanding and executing what they need to know and what they need to do to really avoid this killer, this heart disease killer? Yeah.
I think that's the most important question. And it is extremely important to have a discussion with patients. And we had talked yesterday about that too, that we need to have more education in this particular area of reducing heart disease, talking about the influence of environment, the influence of various factors that can be modified by behavior. Behavioral change is needed. So we have to have a discussion. We have to let folks know, first of all, the different risk factors involved, from high cholesterol to obesity to lack of activity, the amount to reducing emotional stress. And I think that discussion doesn't typically take place or is not given so much importance in a doctor's office, where I think it is the number one thing that we should be doing. I think so to answer your question, first thing would be to have a discussion with the patient, or I would say if this patient is not even a patient, or just an acquaintance, or someone who is interested in knowing about reducing heart disease, is to talk about risk factors, talk about behavioral change, talk about making changes in their diet, in their exercise. Those sort of things are the first thing to discuss in prevention. And I think the next thing, obviously, in my particular practice would be folks who present with certain symptoms is to see, you know, once we have a discussion, we also need to diagnose if they already have something going on. And obviously, then and at that point, those patients are the ones who are going to need more tests and treatment with medication and sometimes with devices and procedures.
Right, exactly. I mean, we had a pretty extensive conversation because, you know, I'm involved in patient education. That's what I do. I'm involved in patient health education training for medical professionals.
And you do some wonderful work, absolutely.
And what we see without question is that patients are, do you remember when that study came out about health illiteracy, how even highly intelligent, highly educated people have no real understanding of how to interpret health information, how to read it, how to understand it, how to be able to respond to it. So it's so important that, and I want to make a compliment about one thing. I have noticed that doctors who are trained outside the United States are far more whole person focused and are far more education focused than American trained doctors. Have you noticed that at all by any chance?
Well, it's a very interesting comment. And, you know, sometimes I hear this comment from the patients as well. I think that the current medical education in the U.S. needs to also add a course, possibly, which talks more about some of the aspects of medicine that we are discussing. Behavioral change should be, we need to talk about that. We need to talk about the person as a whole, like you said. I mean, that's the right way of saying that. We don't need to focus on one particular organ of the body because everything is ultimately connected and, you know, with each other. So we just can't just treat the heart without forgetting about the brain or the emotional aspect, or even in this case, musculoskeletal system that has to move. You know, so you're right. Everything is connected, and we need to have a discussion or add something to the medical education that does pay attention, that makes the medical students think about that, incorporate that in their training.
Exactly. I think what has happened, and I can just say this from having been around medicine for decades, my kids always like to say, Mom, you're as old as trees. You've been around forever. But the one thing that I've noticed is that over the last 30, 40 years, the pressure and the stress and the work on doctors and physicians who are working in medical environments of any kind is so overwhelming that the thought of saying, well, you have to add patient education into this, and that I think doctors are just, I talked to the Massachusetts Medical Association people, and they're citing statistics about depression and alcohol use and drug use and suicide and what have you. There's so much pressure that I think the American system really would do so well to take a more a simplistic approach, a holistic approach, and allow education to be a big part. Now, how do you do that in your practice, doctor? What does it look like in your particular practice?
I think you're very, very important. I think one of the things that we discussed earlier, and I think is so important that you are doing, is to be, it's basically teamwork. It's not just the MD who's taking care of patients, but we have nurses, we have mid-level providers, we have medical assistants, we have different therapists. So I think that's important from an education standpoint in our practice also. We have also empowered our medical assistant nurses that they need to be involved with teaching patients about their heart disease as well. We also have material, written material that we can give out to patients. And hence the book that I wrote is also a manual for patients to read, and not just patients, but anyone who's concerned about heart disease in a very simplistic way. And it basically, you know, that's so some of the ways of how you can teach our patients and anyone, any individual who's interested about heart disease. That's number one step. So I take the team approach in that.
That's great. I love the name of your book, Be Heart Smart. I think that's absolutely fantastic, because we all have to be, we have to be smart about our bodies, about our hearts, about, you gave like the leading causes of heart disease. And I mean, I don't know, I hope this doesn't sound harsh, but I think most of this is common sense. If you've got somebody that is smoking cigarettes, and I'm an ex-smoker and I can say this, if you're continuing to smoke cigarettes after you know what it's doing to you, if you continue to eat constantly, and it only happens if it's constant, overeat, you know, grains and refined sugars and simple carbohydrates, if you continue not to exercise when you know that that's a really important part of staying healthy, when you continue to ignore your blood pressure, I mean, I think some of this, and we talked about this, and I love this part of the conversation, we talked about the psychological component to what does it take psychologically to create heart disease, because there has to be a psychological profile. So, do you want to jump in and talk about that?
Absolutely,
that's a great topic. Yeah,
I think so. I think I think that you are absolutely right. I think that a lot of people feel like that just taking one tablet or one pill is going to solve their problems. But this is a much more complicated issue. The formation of plaques in our coronary arteries, which lead to heart attacks and death in a lot of cases, is not because of one thing that caused the problem. It's multifactorial. So many things are involved. And I think it's so important that we stress to folks about modification of their behavior, like you mentioned smoking. So it's very hard to quit smoking. If you've smoked for many years, it is very tough. That is a very difficult habit to break, and you need a lot of mental and willpower to break that kind of habit, in addition to taking medications that there are quite a few, or patches, or nicotine gums, etc., whatever, what have you. But you're right, there is a behavioral component is very important. There has to be a will. Also, you know, folks who are depressed for whatever reason, or who have a lot of stress in their life, that affects not only just leads to heart disease, but also affects other things. Like there's a higher risk of smoking in patients who have a lot of anxiety and depression. There's a higher risk of diabetes in those people. Those people also tend to have high blood pressures. All of those things are not only causing heart disease, but they cause stroke, heart disease, and many other medical problems. So you're right. Behavioral change, feeling good about yourself, feeling good about your environment, that's an important, very important aspect that we have to keep in mind. And if you don't have that kind of feeling, you're not going to follow the directions of your health providers. You won't be able to take your medicine. You won't be able to quit some of the bad habits that you want to get rid of. So I think you're right. Those are very important factors, and people must take some time to either relax, maybe do yoga, go to the gym, meet their friends, have a social life, and all of those things are extremely important.
Well, for sure. I mean, in the book, The Blue Zones, I'm sure you're familiar with it, The Blue Zones talks about the places around the world where people live the longest and are the happiest and
absolutely,
the most fulfilled. And without question, I think a lot of what we're looking at in our country, and shockingly, I'm sure you just read the terrible statistics on childbirth deaths, maternal childbirth deaths. When we look at our healthcare system, we think it's the best in the world. Unfortunately, we're really falling behind on a lot of this stuff. And when you look at other lifestyles, other countries, other cultures, it's their values, it's the way they approach life that changes the outcomes of their health and wellness. Dr. Walter Willett out of Harvard, he is a friend of our program, and he has done presentations, course presentations on, all the amazing stuff that they're doing over there at the School of Public Health. And he talks about how, this is a cultural phenomena. I don't think in any other culture, and maybe you can jump in on this, I don't think in any other culture has the vast cardiovascular pathology as we do.
Oh, I think we are going in the right direction. There has been a lot of emphasis on anti-smoking campaigns last 25, 30 years, and we have seen a decrease in smoking compared to, let's say, Europe and some of the other countries, but we still have a problem with diet. We still have a problem with fast food and trans fats and saturated fats. And so there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. We have done well. I would say we have done well in smoking, even though we still need to continue to work on it. The smoking still has been on the rise in younger females, for example. So there are still work to be done, but we have done well in that particular area. There are still areas, I think, that we need to work on. I guess when we talk about, on the other side of the Atlantic, particularly Europeans and especially in the Mediterraneans, we know about their diet has gained a lot of attention in the U.S. also, because we have seen a lower incidence of heart disease among people who eat the Mediterranean diet or live the Mediterranean life would be better. I mean, those are the people who are focused more on eating more plant-based foods. They're not eating red meat. They're eating less dairy, adding more nuts and legumes and beans, etc. to their diet. They have one or two glasses of wine daily, red wine daily. These people are also very active. They are not always driving their cars or buses or what have you. They are walking a lot. I think that's what we are lacking. We are become lazy. We are eating unhealthy diet a lot. Something has to be done about trans fats used, particularly in fast foods, and not just fast foods, but any kind of foods. I mean, trans fat is being used a lot. So we need to focus more on monounsaturated, polyunsaturated foods, add more olive oil like the Mediterraneans have done. So you're right. We need to learn from other cultures and countries and see what they're doing right. I mean, to how we can improve our health.
Absolutely. Now, you come from Pakistan, I believe, yes?
I do, yes.
Right. How would you compare, just because you're familiar with it, how would you compare the culture that you came out of with what you see in terms of lifestyle habits of Americans? Do you see, can you compare and contrast and say, yeah, well, this works and that doesn't work? Have you noticed the difference?
I think the Pakistani diet was no better than the American diet. I would not count that as an ideal diet that needs to be followed. It's not close to the Mediterranean diet. However, I guess being a poor country as Pakistan is compared to the U.S., I think people do tend to do more walking. There are people who are bicycling, using their cycles to go to work, and there's just more activity than the U.S., but the diet is still, there's still work that is being done by World Health Organization and other international organizations on, again, teaching folks about reducing fat from their diet, trying to use a better oil. So in those countries, India and Pakistan kind of countries, they are using ghee, G-H-E-E, I might have heard of that, which is
right.
Very, again, rich and more fatty and more...
Isn't that a butter extract, Doctor?
Butter extract. It's a saturated fat. And just for our audience, one way to know the difference between saturated fat and mono or polyunsaturated fat is that saturated fat on room temperature is always solid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you'll see coconut oil being solid, you'll see butter being solid, whereas a polyunsaturated fat or monounsaturated fat is liquid. So the examples would be olive oil, for example, or corn oil, they're always liquid. So avocado oil is liquid. So I think the diet over there is not good. I think that the problem sometimes with countries that are wealthier and per capita income is more can actually go the wrong way too, which is that now that you've got money to buy food, you're buying the wrong foods. And some of these countries, they don't have enough money to buy food. So there's starvation. So I think we have problems in both situations, one where there's not enough food, and another situation there's plenty of food, but the choices that folks are making are not right as to what food is good.
Excellent. Excellent point. We need to take a commercial break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you, we talked about this, and I think it's an important subject. We talked about the loneliness, sadness, the isolation, the depression that very often creates the unfolding of these kinds of lifestyle habits. And most of us have had a taste of that. So when we come back, Dr. Khan, if you will jump in and talk to us about those components. So don't go away, anybody. We're going to be right back with Dr. Wahid Khan. Okay.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-4325. Heal. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected
basically the who's who of integrative health, and they brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
We're talking with Dr. Waqa Khan, who is a medical doctor and the author of the number one best-selling book, Be Heart Smart. And he's sharing with us his experience in working with cardiovascular disease. He is an interventional cardiologist, which is really interesting because it has a lot to do with not only trying to help the condition when it walks in the door, but how to prevent it from reoccurring and how to teach people to prevent this disease from taking a hold of their life. So, Dr. Khan, before the break, we talked about, the other important topics that have to do with heart disease. So if you would elaborate on that.
Sure, absolutely. So, Dr. Nadia, you were talking about, the psychological aspect what the impact of bad psychology, on heart disease. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. How does our depression, how does our sadness, how does, the stress of our lives,
So,
what can people do about that?
I think there was a recent study that I'm sure a lot of folks must have read about it. It was recently reported. It was a long study done by Harvard on 7,500 patients or more, where they looked at the causation or the disease incidence in patients who were either single or divorced who lived by themselves. And I think the interesting conclusions were that folks who were either single or solo, who did not have their partners for whatever reason, either they never got married or never had a friend or got widowed, etc., those folks did much worse than those who had companions, who had lovers or who had husband and wife, spouses, or who had just friends. So I think it was very important that love, relationship, social life, social interaction, being in some type of a group, extremely helped those people in avoiding a lot of diseases. The folks who were solo or single were more depressed and were more prone to develop heart disease as well. They had a higher incidence of heart attacks. So I think there's something to say about, being depressed because you don't have enough social life, and that does affect
or loneliness, loneliness and sadness. Just very recently, I have learned about something called skin hunger. Now, I hope the audience is listening because, you might find this fascinating too. I don't know if you know about it, but there is a condition that's getting some attention finally called skin hunger. And it's usually found in individuals who, marasmus used to be a condition where children who weren't touched or held, they would die, especially in the orphanages, many, 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 many decades ago. But today, a lot of people who are alone, who, maybe were premature babies or who had difficult childhoods and they did not get a lot of physical affection, or people who basically are affectionate, have a craving. It's a physical and psychological craving called skin hunger. And it's about being touched. It's about holding hands.
Absolutely.
It's about getting your back rubbed. It's about all of this. Now, I'm sure, as a cardiologist, you have seen what happens. I'm sure you've held some of your patients' hands and, you've
Absolutely.
Given them that kind of tactile support. You want to talk about that? Because that's a fascinating subject.
I think that's a very interesting subject. In our case, in physicians, you might know that now that the use of, I'll give you this example, the use of stethoscopes is really redundant because stethoscopes were used to diagnose heart murmurs. That was the primary focus on stethoscopes because we can check a pulse by just checking a pulse in someone's hand, wrist. But the stethoscopes gave us sounds and murmurs, and we could tell if somebody's heart failure. We can say somebody has some kind of a regurgitant murmur or a leaky valve or a very tight or stenotic valve. Now we have ultrasound, so we can easily detect all of that much more accurately and objectively with an echocardiogram. So there's no really use for stethoscopes. So what do stethoscopes do now? Stethoscopes is what you just said. That is our way of touching our patient, letting them know that even though I'm listening to the stethoscope and listening to their heart, even though I'll get better information on ultrasound, but that is one way of me as a physician connecting with my patients. Because the use is not there, but the moral sort of use or the connection that I develop start with my patient. It's like an umbilical cord between me and the patient at the time when I'm examining the patient. And you're right. I mean, everyone needs a pat on their shoulder. Everyone needs a hug sometimes. And these patients who come to us open up. And I had a patient today who was having problem with his spouse, and he just opened up and I kind of things he was telling me as his doctor were things that you typically tell your, I guess, your best friend. But he opened up and I unfortunately felt bad because there were things that I could do nothing. I could just offer him my ear, and I think maybe that's all he needed.
Yes,
had to give him some time. So you're right. I mean, we need that tactile touch. We need an ear sometimes to let people, you know, voice out their stories, their problems. And that is therapeutic for a number of patients.
Do you know, Doctor, there are four, you know, the four basic questions. This is out of the University of Washington. There are four basic questions that a patient wants answered. The first one is, are you listening to me? The second one is, do you care about what I'm telling you, about what I know about myself? You know, isn't that
yes,
amazing?
Absolutely.
And just listening, just the presence, just the concentration of looking at someone, listening to someone, caring about what they're saying,
tell me about the skin. Well, you mentioned something about skin. Tell me about what was that. Tell me a little bit about it. I loved what the comment about the skin.
It's called skin hunger. Skin hunger.
Skin hunger. I love that. I mean, that's something to keep in mind. Skin hunger. Yeah.
I will have
absolutely
to send you the article because basically it was from a medical journal. Basically what it's about, it's, you know, the skin is the largest immune organ in our body and it communicates to every cell in our body. And when we're touched in a positive way, it actually creates all kinds of endorphins and enkephalins and all kinds of wonderful hormones, brain hormones that, you know, communicate. It's like if you love somebody and they're holding your hand, it just is so good for your immune system. There was one physician who did studies. He was a surgeon. He did studies about people during surgery and after surgery, and just having people hold the patient's hand changed, stabilized all their
values,
you know, their blood pressure
yes,
and everything
yes,
else. The vital
yes,
signs,
absolutely.
I'm sorry. So it
vital
stabilized
signs, there
their,
you go.
stabilized their vital
yes.
signs. So what yes. we know is that the skin is a tremendous communicator. Now, if you're touched badly, we know what that can do. That can be very traumatizing and very traumatic.
Absolutely.
But if you're touched lovingly or caringly or sensitively, I love what you said about that stethoscope because I've noticed, and I don't know if this is a new thing in medical, training, but the young doctors are more mindful of how they're approaching using their stethoscope. They'll warm it up. They'll make a little joke about it. I hope this
yes.
is too cold. The way they'll put
yes.
their hand on the shoulder, they'll lean in, and they're very mindful about. Now, is this a new part of cardiology training of using that stethoscope as a communication tool?
No, I mean, we don't say that, but I think we all know that as cardiologists that the purpose of a stethoscope when it was first invented, which was probably 200-300 years ago, was to listen to heart sounds and listen to these murmurs, which are swishing sounds that we can hear in a stethoscope, and may make a diagnosis of leaky valves or stenotic valves or patients who are having a rhythm problem. But now we can get that information much more accurately from very advanced instruments. So the need for stethoscope is not there. But I think that it makes the patient feel more comfortable, much better, and more, I guess, satisfied when we do. So
And I think it should be introduced into medical practice, don't you? I mean, what you're saying is so wise, and it's so insightful, and it's so patient friendly and patient supportive that it almost seems there should be a course about it somewhere in medical training.
I think you're right. I think we have become cold. Sometimes what happens is that we get so busy and we are, some of us are in procedural kind of specialties, and we are so mechanical that we forget the aspect of the mind. And so I think we cannot underestimate the mind while we are treating the body.
Right. Speaking of the body, let's talk about the formation of plaque and clots. And I mean, the real, you know, kind of science of heart disease is the presence of these foreign entities that shouldn't be where they are. So can you talk to the audience, explain to the audience how debris and plaque accumulates in the arteries and how it ultimately, you know, gets calcified and causes clots. Can you talk about, walk them through 20 years.
Yes. I mean, I think that what we have to keep in mind is there are many risk factors that we discussed, so I don't have to repeat them again. But folks who have a tendency to form clots, they start forming these plaques, which are basically a buildup of white, yellowish, whitish material that starts developing on the inside of our arteries. And remember, there are two types of vessels, arteries and veins. Arteries are taking good blood from the heart to the rest of the body. This plaque, as we call it, or this yellowish, whitish material, is comprised of various things. One of the main, major core material is bad cholesterol, or LDL. So this cholesterol starts building up. It attracts other bad, parts of the in our such as some platelets and other parts in our blood or little organelles, so to speak. And it keeps building up. It takes years to build up. So they have found out in autopsies of patients who had blockages that even at the age of 6 or 7, in certain people, that process started, which means that family history might be playing some role in it. But it seems to accelerate at some point in our lives. Unfortunately, it is different from each individual. But somewhere in men over the age of 45 and women after postmenopausal age in their 50s, this whole process of plaque formation or blockages accelerates. Now, initially, when there's a simple blockage, which is lining the inside of the arteries, blood is still able to flow through it and there's no problem. But when this flow is obstructed because the blockage has become big enough, that's when patients start having chest pain or shortness of breath, or many other different symptoms can arise from that. That's when the risk of heart attack is high. And when this area gets closed off, because there is a process that gets started during a heart attack, which leads to the clumping of small particles in our blood called platelets. When that happens, we get a clot. And when we get a clot, blood is unable to get to the muscle of the heart, and we have what we call as coronary thrombosis. It's also called, people you've heard in movies and shows, patient had a coronary. That's what they mean. They're talking about a coronary thrombus. The thrombus is a clot. So coronary thrombosis, or a clot in the coronary arteries, which are the arteries that supply the heart muscle. If the artery that's supplying the heart muscle is supplying a large part of the heart muscle, then we are dealing with a large heart attack, or a massive heart attack, as we call it. It can sometimes kill a patient, which does happen in 1/4 of people who are having a heart attack. But these days, we are able to go in very quickly and able to open up these arteries, use some drugs, use stents, and open them up with balloons. So that's how this whole process starts, and that's where we come in and fix it.
Right, but that's in a nutshell. That doesn't happen overnight. I mean, All of this generally takes time, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it take time for this metabolic process to accumulate?
Like I said, like I said earlier, it's in some cases starts at the ages of 6 or 7. It starts in our teenage years. So we need to watch our kids, what they're eating. We need to start paying attention from that age. But like I said earlier, it does accelerate in men, particularly over the 45. There are some men who have a lot of risk factors and they get this disease much earlier. But mostly, majority, 45 of age or older, or in women postmenopausal, then it's very accelerated. In some families, in some individuals who have not been behaving themselves, in other words, who do not have good behavioral modification of what they're eating and how much they're exercising, or they're under a lot of stress, this may happen much earlier. So we are seeing patients now in their 40s, early 40s, who are having heart attacks and getting bypasses or getting stents or balloon angioplasties.
Right, exactly. And you and I both shared this. I believe that exercise, and I have nothing to do with exercise professionally, okay? I want to put that disclaimer out there. I do exercise myself every day, but I don't have anything to do with it professionally. I think exercise has to be, it has to go down as the number one factor in terms of how much you exercise, the intensity of your exercise, the frequency of your exercise, because it appears that people who exercise, they bypass so many of these pathologies, especially heart disease. So do you want to talk about exercise as part of the cardiovascular rehab? Because I know, isn't that a big part of cardiac rehab?
Yes, yeah. So when we talk about cardiovascular rehab, I think most of us assume this is what rehab is typically done after somebody has had a coronary event like a bypass or a heart attack or angioplasty. So then we put them through a rehab where we gradually get them back into shape. We monitor them, and that's done in a sort of a hospital type of environment where they're monitored. Now, also keep in mind that exercise is extremely important in preventing heart disease, as we had talked earlier today too. So the recommendation is that patients must, and I try to keep it simple and not try to get into some very complicated exercise regimens which they'll never be able to follow, but I think that if we are able to do 30 minutes of brisk walking or any kind of moderate type of activity, I'll call it moderate, 30 minutes or so, 4 to 5 times a week, that will be ideal. If somebody is interested in more vigorous activity, when I say vigorous activity, I mean running at more than 6 miles per hour or doing some mountain climbing or something aggressive like that, that could be less. Those they can do that, you know, maybe 2 times a week, 30 minutes 2 times a week. But moderate activity, which is brisk walking or swimming or light jogging, playing maybe, game of tennis, doubles, kind of tennis. Single tennis could be considered vigorous, but doubles tennis game where you've got another partner with you too. Those activities, if they can do half an hour of that 4 times a week, it will be ideal, 4 to 5 times a week. Adding, that's more considered more cardio, where they're trying to get their heart rate up. And when I say up, they raise their heart rate, and it will depend a different rate for different age groups. So it is dependent on your age. But, let's take an example of a 50-year-old individual. I would say getting the heart rate up to 150 would be ideal. So get the heart rate up to 150. And in some cases, it may not get there because they're taking certain blood pressure medicine, which may not allow them to get their heart rate up to that level. But if they're not, I mean, the goal is that. And the other thing I tell patients if they're taking medication is you should be huffing and puffing. You don't have to be like you can't breathe, but you should be able to huff and puff, get a little tired, and you want to maintain that for 5 or 10 minutes if you can. And then you do basically slowly go down, start slowing down, and go back to where your heart rate is back to normal. So you build yourself to an exercise level for 10 minutes, maintain it for 10 minutes, and then slow down for 10 minutes. It's a nice 30-minute regimen.
Right. Well, I tell you, I'm in my 70s, and I have to tell you there's massive confusion. I will look all this information up. What am I supposed to be doing for a female at my age? And some of it I think is wildly unrealistic. I'm supposed to be walking at 3.5 miles an hour? I don't think so. I mean,
that's a little fast.
I have a horseback riding injury. I unfortunately had a really major, major trauma to my pelvis and my hip. You know, I did a job on it. Now, I am very happy going at 2.2 miles an hour. And I do it every day, and I do 30, 40, sometimes 50 minutes, and I'm happy as a lark. Is my heart pounding away? No. Because I think if I had to do that much, I would destroy my hip if I had to do that. So let's talk about this idea that even as, you know, you get older, you're supposed to be working out in the same way you did when you were 50.
Yeah. Well, I think you made a very good point about yourself, and I think that's important. I mean, these days people have watches that are monitoring your Garmin watches, Apple watches, all kinds of stuff that is monitoring your heart rate. So I think one thing you can do, no matter what kind of exercise you're doing, keep an eye on your heart rate. And I think the idea is of a cardio is to get your heart rate elevate. And so if you might be walking at 2.2 miles per hour, especially, or even less when you start a program, and your heart rate will go up very fast. And then you'll see that as you increase the intensity of exercise, the heart rate will not go up as fast. So the best thing is to use those monitors. They're very helpful. A lot of people tell me, and they come to me and my patients say, oh, you know what, I've done 5,000 steps and all that. That's great, but I tell them one thing. It is very important for cardio that you do this exercise continuously.
Yes.
Some people go to work and they walk a lot, but that doesn't count. They walk and stop and walk and stop. For ideal exercises, where you are continuously walking, you are do a continuous 20-minute walk or a 30-minute walk. Walking at work is great. That means you're an active person, but it's not really cardio. That's important message, I guess.
Right. So people, we have to be aware of the fact that we need to give our bodies a bit of a workout every day. You don't use it, you lose it. Doctor, we've got to do our second and last commercial break. We went a little over time because it's such a fascinating subject. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. And when we do, I want to talk to you about the intermittent fasting craze, which I personally think is a great thing because it means that people are eating far less.
Yes, yes.
So when we come back, let's talk about intermittent fasting because it's something that seems to be catching on, and I'd love your opinion, and we can share that with the audience. So we'll be right back with Dr. Khan.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
We are having the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Waqar Khan, who is an interventional cardiologist, meaning that he not only treats the cardiovascular disease, but he works to prevent it with his patients. He's also the author of the number one best-selling book, Be Heart Smart. So, Dr. Khan, before the break, we were talking about what I think is actually a pretty good craze. I don't like, you know, trendy things or fad things, and I'm sure you don't either. But this seems to be something that is catching on and seems to be of great benefit, and that's intermittent fasting, where you don't eat for a 16-hour period and that you eat within a certain number of hours that allows your body to actually rest and rejuvenate itself. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I am not an expert, but I do hear about it from my patients. I can tell you that this intermittent fasting is catching on big time.
Yes.
And I know a lot of younger folks are more prone to adopt that to lose weight. And I think basically it's an eat-stop-eat method. And it looks like people are using different ways of using the eat-stop-eat. One is 16-8 method, which is, you know, like you just told us, where they are fasting for 16 hours in between food. And then there's a looks like there's a 5-2 method. So there are many different ways of doing fasting and eating sort of thing. I think from what I have heard and read is that this type of pattern, of diet pattern, does lead to some positive changes. It leads to human growth hormone, which seems to be higher in patients who are fasting. And this results in turn in losing fat and gaining muscle. I think that is one. The insulin seems to become more sensitive in these patients, and levels of insulin drop dramatically, and lower insulin levels make the stored body fat more accessible. There is some evidence that it could cause some repair in our cellular mechanism at that level. So there are some theories for it, and I think that so far the results from epidemiologically speaking have been somewhat positive. So I think that's why it has remained popular. People have lost weight on it. And I'll be honest with you that I think we still need to know more. So I think that, like I said, there are some changes that are improving sugars, insulin resistance, weight loss, anti-inflammatory changes, lowering of cholesterol. So some of the benefits of that. Also lowering cancer, apparently. So
right.
Some of those benefits.
Well, I always think, I'm a very pragmatic person, and I always think that a lot of health, I mean, look, you had a grandmother, I had a grandmother, we have these wise grandparents, okay? And they, a lot of their health care was, it was very, you know, observational. It was very intuitive. And they would say, you know, eating less was better, you know, not eating as many different foods together, not eating processed foods. And one of the things I think about intermittent fasting is it kind of takes a lot of that wisdom, you know, like don't eat before you go to bed and all. It takes a lot of that wisdom and it compresses it into a practical approach of saying, you know, the less I'm eating, the less wear and tear in my pancreas. I mean, the pancreas, the poor thing, it's involved in every kind of digestion. It's involved in every kind of metabolism. The liver, you know, when we look at our intestines, we look at our bowels. I mean, we look at all of this, and it's kind of like giving them a holiday, isn't it? So I think that from a common sense perspective, it seems to be fine that we're going to lower the amount of wear and tear we put on our bodies, which probably means we're going to take in less calories at the same time. Have you ever prescribed it or recommended it to a patient?
You know, I'll be honest with you, I have not personally incorporated that in my practice. However, I'm fascinated. I'd love to know more because I have heard people doing another diet, which is kind of an intermittent fasting, where they will consume less calories on 2 or 3 days, like very low calories, almost fasting, but not fasting completely. So they'll have like 500 calories on 2-3 days, and then on the rest of the days, they'll eat normal calories. So that's like going towards intermittent fasting, but not completely intermittent fasting. And then the 16-8 method has been very popular where they eat anything they like between the hours of, let's say, 1 to 9 p.m., 1 p.m. and 9 p.m., and then they fast for 16 hours after that. So I think that it seems good to me. I don't see any problem with it. I don't see any bad effects. I think I'd like to see more studies. I'd like to see somebody report, let's say some results from a larger group of folks who have tried that, because everyone sort of behaves differently. But it certainly is an easy thing to do. It doesn't require buying any foods or any packages that you have to, you know, become a member of a certain organization and they send you all this stuff. It's something anybody can do. And so that's one big advantage of that, is anyone can do that. You don't need to buy anything for it.
Exactly. And you know, what I think is so nice about it, what you said is fantastic. You don't have to order food on the internet. You don't have to join a club. You don't have to do any of that. All you have to do is find 8 hours out of your day. For me, it tends to be from 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 9:30 at night. That's when I like to eat. And then the rest of the time, I don't eat anything. And it's amazing, I'll share with you myself, the energy. I have so much more energy when I'm
That's right.
When I'm not consuming all of that food. And I would love to see more tests on that myself because I'm very interested. As a nutritionist, it's one of the things that I do. As a nutritionist, it makes sense to me. Plant-based diet, reducing calories, increasing activity, all of that seems to make profound, good heart and health hygiene. Now, before I can't believe all the time has just flown by. Before we end this interview, I want you to talk about your book, where people can find it, talk about your website, and how they might be able to get in touch with you, Doctor.
Absolutely. So one way to get in touch with me could be through my website. So the website is hearthealthybooks.com. Hearthealthbooks.com, www.hearthealthbooks.com, one word. Also, my book, Be Heart Smart, is available on various sites, but Barnes & Noble, Amazon, will be very easy way for anyone who wants to grab a copy of the book. Also, I know that's available on various sites. If you just put the name on your browser, Be Heart Smart, and my last name, Khan, K-H-A-N, you'll see various different sites where it is available. We'll be able to find it.
Wonderful. I tell you, you are a wealth of information. I mean, I could talk to you about this forever, and I'm sure that people listening really love the approach. You're pragmatic. You demystify it. You're straightforward. You've made it.
Thank you so much.
Very palpable. I love the interview, and I thank you so much for joining us today. And listeners, don't forget to come back and join us again next week for another program on Living Above the Drama that will be educational, informational, and hopefully will inspire you to have a happier and healthier life.